Have you ever had a feeling that something dreadful was about to happen?
This whole premise is sweaty.
Okay, moving right along.
You gonna plagiarize the whole thing for us? Do you have any thoughts of your own on this matter?
Just remember that this thing isn't as black as it appears.
Hold on to your butt.
The only difference between me and Holmes, man, is his job.
I'm glad you're here to tell us.
I'm looking for the least possible amount of responsibility.
And that ain't bad.
I'm in a glass case of emotion.
Man's got to know his limitations.
I'm glad you came back.
In the bag.
Fight, drink it up.
Welcome to the Bag Pod, everyone. Unfortunately, Joe, Doug, and Alan could not be here today, so we've got our usual stalwart and Jimmy TV.
Hey, y'all.
And making his triumphant return to the pod, he's usually on the sports pod, we've got Eugene.
In the building.
As per usual, we'll be discussing both the latest Game of Thrones and Mad Men episodes. So let's hop right into the Game of Thrones. Lots happening today. We get the let's just go right to Renly's camp. We get the first glimpses of Renly's camp. All of his bannermen all around. We get the excellent first scene of Brienne kicking some Loras Tyrell ass.
Doing work.
Yeah. She was definitely doing it up. Jake, though, Jimmy TV, he's got a couple of nitpicky things for this scene.
Well, first off, going with Brienne, is that how you always pronounced her name, reading the books, Bags? I always thought it was Breen.
When I pronounced her name, I thought it was Brienne.
Brienne?
Yeah, Breen.
Brienne would make a little bit more sense to me. I'm not sure where they're pulling Brienne out of.
Yeah.
Well, it's fantasy, you know, so do what feels right. Right, but I guess what kind of throws me for a loop is that we've never really had anyone in Westeros, I guess, with this kind of a name or anything like that. So it just seems kind of random for a higher house like the Tarleys to be have a kid like with his name.
Like Samwell? Tarleys? You mean the Tarths?
Well, yeah, that's where she's – I mean, yeah. Isn't that where she – I mean, I know she's from Tarth, but isn't her liege lord the Tarleys?
I don't know. Perhaps. Oh yeah, that makes sense.
Well, either way, I mean, she's sort of a odd individual, so perhaps it is apropos that the name is not traditional. True that.
Very true.
And I also really disliked Margaery. What she yelled? I think she yelled Loras Highgarden,
yes.
and kind of gave it like a little clap or something like that. And it was just really wooden and terrible.
She was
and,
really into it apparently, but yeah, it came across as really bad.
Yeah,
but she looks like an alien, so that doesn't help.
Well, and it seemed like she was the only one who was really into it. No one else. Everyone else is just kind of like looking.
Oh, no, she was loving it. She had a little bloodlust in her eye.
Yeah.
That wasn't the only kind of lust.
Well, there's no doubt that she gets a little freaky.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt about that.
I think after that whole Loras Highgarden thing, I think they definitely did a really good job of setting up her character during the rest of the episode. But before we get there, we got to talk about Brienne.
Her height?
Breen, whatever. Yeah, no, she's a giant.
Yeah,
huge.
Even when I rewatched the episode, I was trying to see how her height compared to Loras's when they were kind of fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess whatever they added to her to have that effect when she was by Caitlyn, they obviously weren't having in the more physical fight scene, because all of a sudden, yeah, they turn the corner to come up that hill or whatever, and she is twice as tall as Caitlin Stark.
She's like an Amazon.
She's got a weird walk, too, like a George Mirasan walk, so there's a clear incongruity there.
She was obviously wearing stilts. I mean, let's just call it like we see.
No doubt.
Maybe she's just George Mirasan's daughter.
That's also possible.
That's all I've got to say. But I think I liked – they showed Brienne's, her character trait, her main character trait of loyalty, if you will. They definitely made sure that they showed that earlier when establishing her character. And then I thought they did an interesting job of kind of making her a little snippy towards Catelyn, or Caitlyn, however you want to pronounce her name.
Yeah, no, that was perfect. I mean, just for her to be all about Renly.
Yeah, exactly. So I thought the introduction to her was fairly good as well. I was kind of disappointed I didn't get to see any rainbow cloaks.
Yeah, no mention of them either, which means I guess it's not going to happen. In the book, the members of Renly's Kingsguard are called the Rainbow Guard? I mean, something
yeah, I
like
think
that.
They're called the Rainbow Guard.
Yeah, and each one is assigned kind of a different color.
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah. Well, I can see why they excised that.
Well, yeah, but yeah.
Well, at the very least, we haven't come to it yet. So. Yeah.
Well, was his personal guard not called the King's Guard? So, I mean, aren't they clearly not going that direction?
Right. That's what I'm saying. Is that I think they would have made mention of it if they were going to do it.
Unless we're going to get some sort of amazing cloaking scene in the next episode or something. Yes. but yeah, what about, let's get back to Marjorie here. You call her Marjorie? I always called her Marjorie.
Whatever.
after her initial...
She's got all those vowels, son.
Yes. After her initial, Loras Highgarden yell, we learned quite a bit about, dear Marjorie Tyrell.
About both of them, to be honest.
Yes.
Yeah.
She's all about the power. She's all about the power. And, in a way, I can understand. I mean, in such a fraught situation, you can't really be picky. You either got – your guy's got to go all the way or, you're in trouble.
Well, go ahead, Bex.
Okay. I was going to say, I think they've changed up her character a little bit from the books. The Marjorie I've always been used to in the books is more innocent. She's more of a girl, She's more of a teenage girl. She's basically Sansa before Sansa –
right.
Ended up with Joffrey. So the fact that she definitely seemed a little bit more Cersei-like in this episode kind of surprised me. I mean, I've only read through almost the fourth book, so it's not like I know what happens in the... There's only one other book at the moment, correct?
That's correct. And you said you have finished Feast of Crows?
I'm almost done. I got like 100 pages left.
I don't really think there's too much more Cersei, King's Landing stuff, I guess I should say, in the fifth book. So you're really going to see as much as Marjorie as I've seen, at least at this point. But I'd kind of disagree a little bit. I would say she's definitely outwardly like Sansa, but every other character's opinion of her, not in her group, anyone who's had experiences with her, it kind of makes her out to be someone who's not quite so innocent.
And
she is kind of like this underlying thing. And they established Loras as kind of a power character in the first season when he's shaving Renly or whatever, and they're having that scene where he's telling him he should be king and yada 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 stuff.
Yeah, no, I mean, at least when we see Marjorie in the books, like when she's actually in a scene, I don't think we really get the fact that she's as conniving, as planning as perhaps Cersei. But yeah, I mean, clearly, a lot of people in the books have Marjorie pegged out to be a lot of things, lots of hints. And Jake, Jimmy TV, I don't know what to call you. I'm just going to call you Jake. I think you really enjoyed the fact that they made sure that they played up the one bit with the rumor of the Loras and Marjorie fling in the first episode where she's introduced her.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's again one of the other kind of underlying things is that Marjorie and Loras might kind of have a Lannister type
relationship
situation going on. Yeah, and again, in the books, maybe it's just because we don't see them quite as much and really don't know, but it their situation doesn't seem to be as lustful, but they do seem to be very family oriented.
Yeah.
Just all about themselves. Kind of like Cersei said in season one, anyone who's not, a Lannister is our enemy or whatever. They kind of have the same philosophy, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad they did play that up a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, they basically, in the books, they never, at least through the fourth book, they never really come out and just say, it's clear that they're doing each other. But, there's lots of hints. But it was nice to see that it definitely clearly is happening here.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely love each other more than a brother and sister usually would.
They get it on.
I wouldn't go that far, but they're...
Well, it looks like they're about to one way or the other, that's for sure.
right.
But yeah, no, so we get some choice Renly, get some choice Tyrells, but... Let's move on here. Let's go up to King's Landing. Lots of stuff happening. This is the second book is really basically the Tyrion show for the most part.
Right.
So it's good that they've got a lot of Tyrion going on. And this was the first. This was really the first episode, at least of this new season, where we see Tyrion actually using some of his cunning and wit, to show up some people to actually have some plans and stuff. So. I believe the scene where they do the intercutting of him telling the three councilmen where what his plans are for his niece Myrcella was fairly good. Jimmy TV, I think you've got something to say on that as well.
Well, you mean when Cersei's with Sansa and at the dinner table?
I'm talking Tyrion with the council members. In his
tricking them, tricking them to bring out the.
Didn't you say Myrcella though?
Well, yeah, that's the plan. That's what the plan is about. Yeah.
Oh, right. Yes, indeed.
There you go. Jimmy TV on top of his game today.
Yeah, I'm kind of half watching the hockey game in San Jose. Just scored, so it threw me off.
Way to keep it real.
Yeah. I thought it definitely could have came off as being incredibly cheesy if they had kind of quickly cut together all three and kind of gone back and forth or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of glad they let each one kind of, have their own reaction to Tyrion saying stuff. You know, Varys had a good reaction where he said, you know, I love conversations that start that way or something like that. So that was good to see each of them kind of go about, how they react to what Tyrion's saying.
Yeah, no, and we the Littlefinger as well. The Littlefinger growl returns, and he's really excited about the Nine Hall in the initial scene
where he's telling them, you know, what, you know, his false plan or what have you. Littlefinger's growl wasn't too bad, but man, when he came in all pissed off after it all went down, it was so bad.
It was heavy.
Oh man,
he was hanging someone from a roof and
telling
him to swear to him.
Wow. Yeah.
But yeah, no. Was it just me, or were you incredibly shocked when you first saw the cut of Varys sitting where Pycelle was sitting at the very beginning of that first cut before the initial jump.
I guess for some reason I kind of expected it maybe. Okay. It was a little jarring. It definitely was a little jarring.
For them
to be talking about Tyrion's bowel movements and all of a sudden Varys to be right there.
That's kind of how he rolls, though. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That shadowy type situation. But what do you guys think about the potential Varys Tyrion alliance situation? What do you think is going on there? They got the spy as Sansa's handmaiden now.
It's kind of hard to talk about since we've read the books. What's going on?
I'm curious as to what you think. I mean, I always thought that Tyrion and Varys were kind of frenemies. I hesitate to use that because they're never really established as being enemies in the book.
Yeah.
Certainly wary of each other, but really they help each other more often than not.
Yeah, and no, they're kind of...
They go out of their way to do so in a lot of cases.
Yeah, no, Varys is, at least in the show at this point, Varys definitely seems a little bit more hostile towards Tyrion.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, you definitely get more of not a friendship per se, but they definitely at least respect each other and like the mutual plans that they have together. So, yeah, I don't know. So far, it's been a little hostile, but I assume, you know, since it's a 10-episode season or whatever, you know, next episode or the episode after that, we'll have Tyrion and Varys becoming bosom buddies.
Right. And this scene where Varys is, after it's all gone down and Pycelle's been outed or whatever.
Exactly.
And Varys tells him his little riddle or whatever, which isn't really a riddle, just kind of an anecdote, I guess.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, it's definitely a nod to his respecting Tyrion or where Tyrion was going with that.
Exactly.
Which was starkly different than how Littlefinger perceived it, throwing his little hissy fit.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see the contrast between Tyrion and Ned here, how the council members react to them, because they all kind of felt Ned was a joke, you know, in the first season.
Right.
None of them really respected him. You know, you had Littlefinger prancing about doing his Littlefinger things, and Varys, you know, kind of helping him, but knowing that he couldn't really, you know, he couldn't really back that horse.
He would get handcuffed. That Ned would be handcuffed by kind of his own
his inability to play the game, you know.
Right.
Exactly. That's the difference, is that Tyrion, you know, he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, he knows at least it's a game, and he can play it very well, as opposed to Ned, who did not want to play any games at all.
Yeah.
See where that got him.
Yeah.
Exactly. But yeah, no, speaking of the handmaidens, Shay, Tyrion's Sally on the side, if you will.
She's terrible.
Yeah, horrible. I told you she's terrible.
It's superfluous character, almost, in a way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Tyrion's supposed to, you know, as Tyrion says in the episode, she's supposed to be his weakness. I can't fathom why anyone would put so much stock in this person.
I mean, not only that, but they don't really have any on-screen chemistry anyway.
Yeah, that hurts also.
Almost every scene we've gotten of her so far is her bitching at Tyrion this year.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
and a little too crass, too. I mean, it almost seems a little contrived, you know?
Yeah. Definitely. It's contrived, and it's clear that, like, she doesn't respect him at all either, you know?
Right. Right.
So I think that's definitely hurting this whole thing where, you know, for much of the second book, you know, it's about Tyrion trying to keep her safe. Now, clearly, I think it looks like they're going to play that down a little bit, even though they made the move from her to make her Sansa's, you know, chambermaid.
You can correct me if I'm wrong here. At the end of the second book, she was Sansa's handmaiden, wasn't she?
Yes. But that didn't happen until the end.
But she was in the whorehouse for a while, just being kind of kept under wraps, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Did she ever work in the kitchens in the book? I was trying to think of that, too. She did, right?
I want to say she did for maybe, like, for a short time, and then she was like, I'm not doing this. And then
that's when they got her into Sansa's thing?
Yeah, but that happened, like, right at the beginning of the book, too, I feel like. Like, there wasn't any of this pussyfooting around with, like,
we definitely got to know that one whorehouse and a couple whores in it a little bit better than in the series.
I mean, I assume that we probably won't be getting any of that.
Right.
So.
Well, no, I think it's we're definitely not. I mean, isn't that kind of how Tyrion ended up, you know, befriending a couple of these, you know, not in a sexual way by any means, but kind of befriending a couple other whores? And isn't that how he kind of ended up being so pissed off at Janos Slynt and stuff like that?
Exactly,
about the whorehouse stuff? Yeah.
That, and also it's kind of like Cersei throws it back in his face at some point in the second book, too, so it should be interesting to see what exactly they do.
I think the cuts that they made were fine, and they've played it, you know, I'm just trying to half remember kind of things.
Yeah, I got you. But yeah, no, Shay is incredibly annoying, and you definitely don't get to feel anything between those two, so...
Yeah, because that is a good point, because her scene with Sansa wasn't nearly as cringeworthy, I would say. I guess mainly because there's a little bit
she
more
emphasis on... She didn't have to say anything, either,
right,
really.
Right, there's more emphasis on Sansa, who actually was really good in both of her scenes.
I agree.
But Shay just kind of had to walk back and forth, and that was kind of bad.
I mean, Sansa is going to be that way for the foreseeable future. So it's good that they ended up casting someone that can play that part very well. I enjoyed the scene where she was eating with Cersei and Myrcella and Tommen. I thought that was a really good scene with her. And again, like, Cersei is just...
terrible.
Yeah, she is just cut like...
like a mean person.
She's a mean, nice, you know.
Yeah.
She needs to watch some of these recent movies about bullying. I mean,
that's true. That's true. It is a little ridiculous.
I mean, it's pretty bad.
Like she's just laying into him each time. Yeah. Like, how
but don't
times?
You feel that, like, some of it though is that she feels like she's losing her grip on power a little bit? You know what I mean? And so these people who she can manipulate and take it out on, it's almost like upping her cruelty level. You know.
Yeah, definitely, and it's actually going to be really interesting to watch, because her and Sansa are both falling apart,
right.
Just two different ways, they're going about their instability, yeah. I guess, different ways. Where, yeah, I mean, Sansa's is always on the verge of having a mental breakdown, and her way of coping is by, just crying and just kind of, doing whatever, crawling into a fetal position in the corner. Whereas Cersei's is to start throwing cups and the plates at Tyrion,
Right.
And obviously, since she's in a power position, her decisions are going to be a lot more impactful than Sansa's. So.
True.
Exactly.
So far.
Yeah.
Speaking of fetal positions, crawling in the corner.
Yeah.
I believe we had quite a buxom lass crawl into the corner when Grandmaster Pycelle was being arrested, if you will.
Yep.
Pycelle shocked.
Yes.
Yeah, he was.
I was hoping we'd get to see a little bit of the old man shuffle before they took him off, but I guess he was more powerful than anyone thought as he was struggling.
A little springiness.
Mm-hmm.
Can we also just say that when Tyrion turned around and gave the second little gold coin, that was priceless?
Oh, that was money. Him kind of looking at Pycelle, realized what was going on. I was like, yeah, she needs a little bit more than that.
Yeah. We're going to give her an extra nice tip here.
Yeah.
Definitely the chopping off of the what did he say exactly?
The manhood, chopping off of the manhood, yes. With the axe there? Yes.
Exactly.
And feed it to the goats.
Yeah, that was a nice callback from
But there are no goats. Book.
But there are no goats, half man.
Exactly. So that was nice as well.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I mean, I think that's about all we've got from King's Landing.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
All right. Let's go up north, I guess, right? Let's talk about Arya first, and then we'll keep on keeping on here. We get some more Arya scenes.
And just the one at the end, right?
Yeah. It was very good.
It was a lot of happened.
I definitely liked, I don't remember this in the book, but I definitely liked the conversation between her and Yoren.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely had conversations in the books, but I don't think any of them were about that stuff. And we certainly never got Yoren's backstory to why he had taken the black.
Right.
But it was perfect. I mean, it was really good. It's a shame.
For sure.
It's a shame that Yoren's not going to be in the series anymore.
I know. I love that guy. So I thought they could have killed somebody else. I felt.
They could have, but that's not George R. R. Martin style. Yeah, I mean, I literally wrote down, "Uh-oh, Yoren's getting too likable."
Mm-hmm.
obviously, I knew what was going to happen, but they didn't have to do that. They didn't have to make it quite so likable. Had this really nice scene with Arya, and then
Well, Yoren definitely pulled a Boromir there. He gets shot in the shoulder, and he just starts swinging. Nothing's
going all adrenaline on him.
I mean, I think the series has established that Yoren's not gonna go out
like some bitch,
like little punk, yeah, like Lami, complaining with the arrow in his knee.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, I really liked the conversation there with Yoren and Arya, and it was nice to see where she kind of got this prayer thing that it's going to end up popping up probably a lot over the next few seasons. So I think that was kind of cool to see kind of for them to give an origins of that.
I agree.
But yeah, no, Lami.
I mean, I don't know what he was thinking. Like, why do you not just like try to play dead or something in that situation? Like, why are you talking?
Or at least try to walk. I mean, come on. Like, obviously these guys aren't going to carry. They're not going to carry.
Yeah, seriously. They just killed a bunch of people in your group looking for one dude. Like, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a shame though that he didn't yell yield at some point or another.
The entire scene was a lot different. Not a lot different in the book. I mean, I definitely always thought that there were attacking more of like a castle kind of, random tower thing than just like kind of a house. Yeah. Obviously budgetary reasons. We're going to bring that back, and they did fine. But there's a good long stretch where Lami's sitting in the middle of nowhere, just yelling, yield, 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 until someone finally comes on to him.
Wow. That's never good.
Yeah.
That's how Lami do. But yeah, no, well, I mean, now Arya's story gets interesting as she kind of has to wander and find her own way with some of her people. So we'll see how close, how much time will pass before she ends up,
Well, I mean, it's
the next big thing in her story happens.
Well, I mean, this might be a semi spoiler. I mean, they've pretty much established that she's going to Harrenhal, right? Did they say that? Already? I don't know. It doesn't really matter. In the books, nothing happens between here and there, I don't think, really, too much. So the next time we're probably going to see her, I would think, would be going to into the castle,
going
right?
To Harrenhal.
So, I mean, I would guess that there's going to be a couple episodes where we don't see Arya. It's going to be the next couple and then kind of picking her storyline back up later.
Yeah.
But the two main bad guys in the scene were Sir Emery Lorch and Polliver, who are two of the kind of more sinister people that you see in Westeros also. So
and
that was kind
part of the Mountain's crew, right?
That is true, yes. Okay. Yeah.
But yeah, moving on north yet again into Winterfell for a couple choice scenes. Maybe one, I guess, really. The return of the dreaded Wolf Cam.
See, I thought the Wolf Cam was great.
Yeah, I thought it was much better.
But I didn't
this time.
Realize it was the Wolf Cam. I'm gonna be perfectly honest. I thought we were just. I mean, it was. I knew obviously the person that we were behind was
Hodor.
It was Hodor. Mm-hmm. And I was at first really. I didn't understand why people kind of kept getting out of his way and like kind of making faces. I think there were like two people that do it kind of like shut away from him. And I was like, man, they never said that Hodor was like, you know, this disgusting beast or anything like that. I was like, why are these people shying away from him? And then as soon as he opened the door and the camera kind of bounded up, you know, up to Bran, I was like, oh, that's why. That part was terrible. But then when I was rewatching it and I knew that it was going on, I was like, man, they should just always do the Wolf Cam and just kind of a little bit steadier, you know.
Yeah, I mean, thing. I thought it was really good. It was nice that they didn't do the weird, like, faded corners sort of thing that they did on the first Wolf Cam.
I guess what really throws me off is when they start doing, like, the big kind of sweep and motions and stuff like that. That's not... I would compare it to the first person cam in Doom, which was terrible. If anyone else has saw,
yeah,
I'm sure a few other people have seen that movie with Carl Urban.
I've seen it.
At the end, they go into a little first person cam and they're trying to be really gamey and everything's like kind of slow and smooth and it's not how the game felt at all. It always kind of threw me off. And I would compare the Wolf Cam to that, where they're trying to do a little bit too much, I guess, maybe, or try to make it really cool and neat and just need to kind of simplify it maybe a little bit. They need to do something with it.
It's not working. It should be interesting to see how they kind of do some of the more action-packed wolf scenes where, like, he's hunting or, you know, I think there's one where they fight at one point. He fights another wolf.
Yeah, I mean, he takes over a wolf pack or something like
that.
Yeah,
exactly. So it should be interesting to see how they end up doing all that.
Yeah.
But yeah, and other than that, we had a nice little speech by Maester Luwin there about magic and dragons and giants being.
Yeah, he had that great quote something about magic. The days of magic are gone. There are no dragons. There are no giants. The children of the forest are forgotten.
Yeah.
Obviously, we know that there are dragons.
That's true.
And there is magic. So
dramatic irony.
Yeah.
You can probably take those other two things that they say in that line with a grain of salt. And obviously, that's a bit of foreshadowing. But yeah, I mean, that Maester Luwin is just awesome in general. I'm glad they gave him some lines.
Yeah, I'm glad as well that they brought in the whole Maester's chain.
That's
basically been forgotten for the most part, besides a little clinking here and there.
Right, like, so why the hell are these old guys walking around with these chains?
Exactly.
And now I kind of understand it a little bit better.
Yeah, so I thought that was a good addition there.
Definitely.
And then north of the wall with Jon Snow, he's
last seen being cold cocked.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. He's much more rebellious than in the books than I can remember him.
Sticking his nose where it doesn't belong.
I guess so. I mean, that's what happens when Craster's
his large friend
Samwell. I think John was kind of like that in the books. He was definitely smoother about it and not nearly as snarky about it.
Yeah,
you know?
He definitely
didn't get like caught it or like chastised really that much. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's interesting to see. I mean, they're clearly. this whole hostility thing is clearly setting something up for later in the book. Because their first trip to Craster's Keep was, you know, it was fairly uneventful, besides the whole Gilly thing. This was definitely something, some new hostilities as well. And I think it's going to end up working in Jon Snow's character as a whole, because even though in the book he's one of the POV characters, you never really get the sense that he's growing. Like he has a bunch of things that he does that end up growing him into like a more fleshier character.
Right.
So I think this is going to end up helping them, because we'll end up seeing a little more progression from his character.
I would definitely agree with that. Yeah, I mean they kind of establish him early as this one character, and he definitely doesn't really grow.
No.
Whereas pretty much every character who doesn't die does. So.
Yeah. So
in
the
books.
Yeah, so I think they're doing a pretty good job with that in the show. Where do we think they're going to be ending up here next? Do we think maybe we don't get any North of the Wall stuff for a couple episodes? Maybe
I think perhaps
shot,
at least for one episode. Mm-hmm. I think given that we didn't see the Dothrak lands, the East lands, if I'm not mistaken, I kind of have a feeling that, you know,
we'll
now they may
out.
Jump. I mean, obviously they foreshadowed that they were going to go back to that, to you know what I'm saying, I think. So we won't see North of the Wall, I think, for a second here.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't get any Danny. We didn't get any Rob or Jamie. And we didn't get any...
We didn't get any Stannis.
Any Stannis, right. Obviously, I think, I'm pretty sure the next episode is when we're going to... This was in the trailers.
Okay.
The scene, obviously, with Renly and Stannis talking.
Mm-hmm.
In the field with Caitlin.
The parlay,
if you will. And it looks like we're also going to get that super awesome scene with Davos in the next episode. So I actually wouldn't be shocked if we don't get Jamie again for another couple of episodes. Batman probably knows what I'm talking about. But, yeah, I mean, I don't remember much more about what happens in North of the Wall. There's definitely a couple scenes that stand out, and they cast Ygritte or whatever.
Yeah.
So I would certainly think we're going to see
her by the end of the season.
Her definitely, but and before her, a couple more members of the Night's Watch, some of the guys from one of the other towers or keeps or whatever. But yes, that does not need to happen in the next couple of episodes. So.
Do we think we'll end up getting some wolf dreams north of the wall, perhaps? Because I believe Jon suffers from the same affliction.
He definitely does, and so does Arya. So it'll be interesting to see if and when we start doing that.
Well, Arya definitely had. I feel like Arya brought up the fact that she's dreamt of being a wolf before or something in the series. I feel like she's mentioned it at least once.
She might have.
But Jon, I don't think has said anything to that. To that effect yet, so. But yeah, only one more place in Westeros to go here, going over to the Iron Islands.
That's right.
Going to visit some Greyjoys.
Yep.
They are ugly people.
They are very dirty as well.
Yes. Yeah, they are. They are. They're very unclean, uncouth civilization.
Very true.
That's true. I mean, I'm all for paying the iron price, but do you have to look so bad doing it?
You got to be a dick about it.
Apparently you do, according to Balin there.
Yeah. But yeah,
the real question, has anyone used that in real life since?
Paying the iron price?
Yeah.
No, that's gold.
I've been looking for the right moment, but I've yet to find it.
I'll definitely try to chip it in there. Anytime someone tells me that they'll give it to me for free, I'm going to say no.
I'm going to pay the iron price.
Yeah, demand that I'll pay the iron price.
And then Jimmy
and then punch him in the face and take it.
You'll go through some sort of intense physical trial, and then you'll have your free ice cream cone.
Yeah, exactly.
Again, not like in the book, where the book, Theon is definitely more... We don't get any sort of Theon turning scenes. Theon basically, once he leaves Rob, is all Greyjoy all the time.
I mean, he pretty much flips the switch. I mean, as soon as he leaves Rob Stark's side, he is ready to be an Ironborn, ready to go. And we definitely never never see him kind of fumbling with. I mean, we, you know, they give the impressions that he likes Rob Stark, but they, you know, he never really likes Ned. I mean, he never really feels allegiance to the Starks, I would say, other than Rob being the closest in his age, and you know, he sees Rob as himself, as born, you know, the son of a great lord in Westeros, soon to be, you know,
I thought that it was good, you know, they kind of completed the mini arc there, where they had created this whole inner conflict within Theon.
No, I mean, by
the end of this episode,
like you said with Jon Snow, I mean, it's great to see another layer of depth to his character, especially one that's definitely believable and conceivable, you know, and it's definitely going to help him out a lot. I mean, you're really going to see stuff with him, obviously, as he's going through the North. You know, he's going to run into some struggles internally.
I think it was good as well to bring back the whole incestuous fondling scene.
I could have done without that, actually. I thought that I was ready to forget that.
Well, I mean, I think it helps establish some of the characters as to why the hell it was happening in the first place.
I guess I do like that Yara explained why she did it.
Right, right.
Yeah, because it's
why she allowed it to happen.
It's quite shocking, regardless.
Yeah.
But at least there's some sort of explanation there. Eugene, I've got a question for you.
Pose it.
What do you think of the Greyjoy's battle plan here?
Well, I mean, I have to say, I think that it's somewhat savvy, but you know, they're pillagers, they're not conquerors, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. I mean, okay, so they're going to raid it and they're going to get a bunch of money, and then what are they going to do? Just go back to the Iron Islands and demand that they be given some sort of, you know, dominion over these lands? I mean, it seems like if they came into full contact with the Northern forces, they would not do well. But I will say this, you know, it's a bad look for our friend, the King of the North here, because without a doubt, it's going to raise the tenor of his bannermen to want to go back home, you know, and protect their families.
Oh, that's a great point, Gene.
Yeah.
About the North wanting to defend their homelands. And it's also, yeah, like you said, it's incredibly short-sighted by Balon Greyjoy. I mean, what is he? Obviously, he sees a weakness and he wants to exploit it. But what does he expect to happen? I mean,
he'll be in the exact same position he was before. Where, I mean, listen, even if he does that, say he's able to be as successful, eventually whoever consolidates their rule over the kingdom will turn on him because he's such a liability. So just like he did to Robert Baratheon, he's going to have to bend the knee and be back in the same spot.
Right, yeah. Right. Does he complains about how he doesn't want to join up with the Starks because, you know, he doesn't see the point in it, but does he not realize that by taking out the Starks, he's joining up with the Lannisters? And like, does he really think Queen Cersei is going to just give him the North? Obviously that's not how it's going to happen.
It's weird because he's always talking about independence, and I believe the rebellion that they mentioned in this episode was just for them to have their independence of the islands.
Yes.
So
yes.
The fact that Balin is trying to – he's basically playing Risk here, except he's only got, like, a horse, and he's trying to take over – all of Eastern Europe. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a great analogy to bring up Risk, because, I mean, it would be like, yeah, if they cleared out, if, like, some, you know, someone in Europe was about to fight someone in Russia and cleared out all of their Eastern or Western countries and, you know, to move them into the East. And so they were just one kind of army, you know, kind of sprawl along. And, yeah, they just have, you know, a tank or something like that, and they're just going to, you know, obviously they can run through that area pretty easily, but they're not going to have any kind of a foothold in it to hold it.
They're not going to be able to hold it at all. And so, I mean, I don't see what exactly he's trying to prove here except
to be a dick to his son.
Yeah, exactly. The plan lacks any planning, really. He's just, I mean, if they were going to just sort of raid the bay towns or whatever, that's one thing. But they're actually trying to hold on to some lands here.
Right.
And, I mean, that just doesn't seem to make any sense, especially since his seat is on an island. Like, how is he going to be able to govern the lands that he takes anyway?
Yeah.
So,
obviously he's not the best strategist. That's why they seem to not end up in a good position over and over.
Yes. Balin Greyjoy needs to read some Art of War, methinks.
Yeah, definitely.
But I believe that's going to do it for Game of Thrones here, right? Do we have anything else that we'd like to...
there was the second Ironborn scene where you get a little bit more of the drowned god, and he's being kind of re-baptized, kind of establishing himself as being an Ironborn and not a northern person. And we get one of the bigger lines in the series with the "what is dead may never die but rises again harder and stronger." That was nice. I kind of would have liked to have seen two things. One, I would have liked to have seen them bring in one of Theon's uncles.
You don't think that was the damp hair?
No, definitely not.
I thought it was the damp hair. I mean,
he
looked kind of like Balin a little bit. And, I mean, why would you baptize your son? Why would you have some random priest baptize your son when your brother is...
I think they would have came out and said that it was him.
Aaron.
Oh my God! I've always had this person in my head as to what I think Aaron Greyjoy looks like. Mm-hmm. I'm right now. I mean, I have no idea what. I think he's in one of the. Yep, I know what it is. He's in the Kevin Costner Prince.
Wow.
Robin Hood movie. He's Little John.
Prince of Thieves.
He's Little John in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Wow, you might be right.
With much longer hair and seaweed stuck in.
Yeah, very similar looking. Yeah, well, hey, you know.
And obviously they've made the older Greyjoys to be a little bit older, I guess, than however I pictured them.
I mean, they've made everyone about 2 to 4 years older anyway, so.
Yeah. So I'm trying to think what the hell the other guy's name is. What about the dad? Oh, God. Oh, screw it. Anyway, I was kind of disappointed they didn't establish him as a character. I guess I just didn't really want to. Again,
they
this is my opinion.
People.
Haven't really cast them yet or anything like that. Wanted to hold off on that stuff.
Yeah.
The other thing that I would have liked to have seen them do is in the later books, he has his own way of baptizing people.
Yeah.
And I think it's mainly to baptize people who are going into the church, kind of the underlings in the church. Mm-hmm. Where instead of just, you know, and this is obviously true in Christianity too, where in some sects of Christianity they don't just kind of splash water in your head, they kind of dunk you in water, obviously.
Right.
And on the Iron Islands, they straight up drown you.
Yeah, they do.
And then do CPR and bring you back to life if the drowned god, you know, deems it so.
Yeah.
And I think it would have been kind of cool for Theon to be so it back into the Ironborn that he would allow himself to be drowned and brought back to life. But yeah,
that's deep. I assume that that probably wouldn't have flown even if they had introduced the damp air, just because. You know, you're probably not going to try to drown a member of the royal family.
Right, right.
So, yeah, well, it definitely would have been cool.
You know what I'm saying? You're not afraid to be drowned.
Yeah, no, yeah. Well, yeah.
And again, and that's one of my problems with Yara so far is we have not seen her be anything special.
No, yeah, she hasn't done much. She's supposed to be kind of this badass with loyalty and everything, but so far she's just been kind of like a snippy sister.
Yeah, and she doesn't exude it at all. Yeah, she just seems, yeah. So we'll see how she keeps going. I'm not liking it so far.
Yeah. But, I think that will actually do it for Game of Thrones this week.
Definitely, and this was a great episode, and I mean, I think they've established kind of the tenor for the rest of the season, and it took the first season, I would say, to hit like maybe the sixth or seventh episode.
Yeah.
Really, that scene with Ned and Jaime where they have their fight at the end of the sixth episode, when you realize that things are really about to start hitting the fan, I think they've already, you know, you feel that right now, and we still have 7 episodes left, so this is going to be really exciting. I can't wait till next Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, Game of Thrones in general, the first book, is a lot of setup for the most part, so, it looks like we're going to be action-packed throughout for the rest of the time. Should be interesting to see where Dany comes in the next couple episodes.
See where she
comes. But, I think other than that, we will bid adieu to Jimmy TV for the week.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm out of this piece, y'all. Phone with Holla.
Matt. Later.
Ah, peace.
Bam.
All right, now that we've gotten rid of Jimmy TV, it's just I and the Eugene.
Like old times.
Mm-hmm. Chatting it up about some Mad Men. Like I said earlier, unfortunately, Alan is not here with us today. He had a prior engagement. I believe he is acting in a USC student film.
Well, that's exciting. That's very exciting.
Yes, it is. But he offered up a few talking points, so we'll incorporate those into our pod. Eugene is a big fan of Mad Men as well.
No
so
doubt.
It's not as if he knows nothing here. So hopefully he'll be able to add some timely commentary.
I'll do what I can.
To the discussion. This week's episode, I believe this is episode 5 of season 5.
Yeah.
It was a very Pete-centric episode.
There's no doubt about that. A very Pete-centric episode. But, you know, in a way, show stolen by Lane.
Oh, yeah. We'll get to that in a minute here. But I think it was good to finally have Pete. I mean, we've been kind of getting hints of Pete throughout the year, and it was kind of good to have like an episode that was basically about Pete. It's always nice to have an episode about Mad Men that kind of takes the focus off of Don and puts the focus on other people in the office. And since Pete has kind of been trying to at least assume a larger role of power in the office, I think this is the perfect time for a Pete episode. I have to say that I was kind of liking Pete there after the first couple. I mean, the first season you're supposed to hate him, and you do hate him. But you know, he kind of grows on you, and especially in seasons 3 and 4. And then, even though he was kind of being a dick to Roger earlier in the season, I mean, I felt it was justified.
Right. I mean, Roger obviously is not the kind of guy who was out there to spare people's feelings.
Exactly. But this episode made you hate Pete all the more. Brought the original hatred back. He was in top form this episode between his bragging about the stereo and the hitting on 16-year-old girls.
Yeah, that was low.
It was something else.
I mean, I guess part of me right now is I agree with you in the general point about it's good when they take the focus off of Don, but I almost feel like Pete's storyline is a little bit like the Don storyline in the first season and the second season. Like the life in the suburbs is really kind of empty, and you know, Don now lives back in the city and Pete really wants to live back in the city. I mean, obviously there's a lot of differences between them, but I don't know, part of me just kind of feels like, well, like, okay, but have we kind of seen this before?
Well, I mean, we have, but I think it's interesting to point out that it kind of fits into the whole theme of what seems to be this season's theme, is where everything's changing and no one's really fitting in.
Right.
Because, you know, Pete is kind of having his rise like Don would have had, where he's got the perfect wife and, like, the perfect suburb home or whatever.
But bringing in all the accounts.
Yeah, exactly. But because so much is changing at the moment, he's kind of not... He's not allowed to have that sort of happy time that Don originally had, you know? I mean,
and he's also more inept than Don is. Yeah. I mean, I actually really liked the sink scene, I thought.
Yeah.
I mean, it just showed so – I mean, you got the 16-year-old girl. The guy can't fix his sink. He's tired of being bossed around by his wife all the time. I mean, he's just so inept as a character.
Yeah.
Can't even beat up an old man.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think they pointed out later in the episode, like, what new accounts have you pulled in lately, too? So it's not even like he's like killing it at his job either. He's just kind of stuck in this no man's land where he's not Don. He's not going to be as handsome or as charming as Don. But at the same time, he can't enjoy his home life either. So
right.
I think it's just really, he's in sort of a purgatory, if you will, right now, and it should be interesting to see where he goes from there. If maybe he's basically just a holdover from a bygone era. He's not an old guy, he's
right.
A young guy, but he was raised in all this 50s with all the 50s sensibilities.
Right.
So I think it's interesting to see where he the likes of he and Peggy, and even Ken Cosgrove might fall. Where on the spectrum, if they end up sticking in the 50s or if they go forward to the 60s.
I actually really like the Ken Cosgrove writer storyline.
Yeah. They brought that back.
And I thought the way they ended it with him writing the little story inspired by Pete was nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But did you get the sense that it was actually Peggy who told on him and not Pete?
No, I always thought it was Pete. I thought it was okay. I think it might even happen. I don't know if it does or not, but I mean, you know, clearly Pete was drunk, so
yeah.
At some point or another in the night, I figured it would have just slipped out, you know. So I thought it was always Pete to begin with.
Mm.
But yeah, no, it's interesting to see people trying to have their own lives
right.
away from the office, but not being, or at least the people that they work with not wanting them to have their own lives, you know?
Yeah, it is an interesting tension. They all want to have their own lives, but then they don't want anyone else to.
Exactly. I mean, you with Ken's writing, you know, he's trying to keep it a secret, and everyone is basically like, they're just really surprised that he's still doing that. Like, they feel like basically his life should be his job, I guess.
Yeah.
Is what?
Well, I mean, because it kind of is for most of them. I mean, to such a high degree. And yeah. it's almost like they don't know what social relationships they should have, like how Don is so resistant to socializing with them. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, they have to spend so much time together, but none of them really necessarily want to be friends with each other, but they almost have to be because of the situation. And if they don't, then, you know, they won't really do much of anything. And it's just kind of like they don't really know how to manage that work personal relationship given the amount of time they spend together.
Yeah, exactly. So it was nice to see that Cannon was going to continue to write.
Yeah, for sure. When he said he was giving it up, I was a little disappointed. And then I liked that he was like, no, I'm going to go for it. And, I mean, his wife is rich. So, you know, he doesn't necessarily have to be as worried about losing that job.
Now, I can't remember this from any of the previous episodes, but where did this random Ken-Peggy
pact come from? I have no idea, but if I'm not mistaken, it was maybe actually, was it two seasons ago when they were talking about going out? Like, it was very unclear what was going to happen with the firm being bought, and that he had – remember that he had gone to that other
– Yeah.
Firm? I mean, maybe there were – I don't remember, but I couldn't remember anything.
The original firm and
right,
Pete
right.
came over or whatever.
And I couldn't remember anything last season or this season, so I almost feel like it had to have been something like a holdover from two seasons ago, because Mad Men will do that to you.
I mean, I feel like it might just be a new thing, which I thought it might have been kind of sloppy to just like try to add this throwaway line that's clearly going to have some bearings later down.
Later down, yeah, for sure.
Because I don't think I've ever seen Peggy and Ken have like a friendly conversation before in the entirety of the show.
Yeah, I don't really remember them ever really being tight, which was kind of weird to me.
Exactly. And, I mean, I guess it might make some sense because, you know, Peggy and Pete have all that history. So, naturally,
right.
when Pete and Ken became the two heads of accounts, you know, she would gravitate towards Ken because of the history with Pete. But still,
right.
I don't know. I think that was incredibly random. I was watching with my roommate, and we just looked at each other and were like, where is this coming from?
Yeah, I feel that.
So I don't know, but well, I'm sure it'll come back up later in the series here. Speaking of head of accounts, I suppose. We get more Roger. We get more of Roger,
which I always love.
Yeah, he's continuing the whole beaten man routine.
Yeah.
But it was really kind of refreshing to see that he actually, I mean, aside the fact that he's clearly depressed about what his life has become and
right.
how he's not needed anymore, but it was refreshing to see him actually, like, give pointers to Lane.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I'm a little surprised you were surprised at that. I mean, I saw that in some of your pre-show moments. I mean, I always saw him as that guy. I mean, that's his thing, schmoozing and winning people over. It's just the more substantive things that he
has. I mean, it's not surprising to me that he's good at it. It was just surprising to me that he had it almost down to a science.
Right. And that he can modulate his drinking.
Exactly. I mean, when he goes into these meetings, all you kind of see him, you know, you see him be like a carousing, you know, magnetic personality, and you see him drinking all over the place, but like, never ever. I don't think I've ever seen, or I can't remember, where Roger's actually in a meeting and he's going through these steps. So it was interesting to see that he has kind of like the whole getting an account thing as a science, down as
true.
A science, and that he was actually willing to help Lane out.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, I mean, I guess he realizes it's the future of the firm in a way, you know what I mean? And that's, it's got his name on it, so he better do something.
Yeah, yeah. So, and
it's
then,
interesting.
But then, of course, with Roger, he's still trying to cling on to any power that he once had, and while he's also reminiscing and just generally depressed at how much power he's lost. And, you know, that theme was continued throughout this episode.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, obviously, the slow decline of Roger Sterling as a force inside the office is clearly a main theme this year.
It's interesting to me that they're keeping Bert, like, Bert Cooper hasn't been a real character basically ever.
Yeah, I know, but he's around. He's in so many scenes too,
exactly.
As almost like a piece. He's like a piece of furniture, you know.
I don't know.
He's
why
just
they
always
keep
in
him.
There.
Like, I don't understand what he's doing there.
I mean, I don't really know either. I mean, you'd think that he would just, like, stay home or something. But, you know, maybe he just needs something to do during the day. But, yeah, it is kind of strange how he is just kind of in all these scenes, yet doesn't really do much of anything.
Mm-hmm. Lane delivering on the threats of Roger from previous episodes where Roger threatened Pete that he would end up beating him up.
Lane throws down. Lane rolls up the sleeves, takes off his glasses, gets in the old style Notre Dame mascot boxing stance, and with one of the worst fight scenes I've ever seen in a modern TV show. I mean, it looked like a John Wayne movie from 1965.
Yeah, the staging was really bad.
But nevertheless, Lane put Pete on his rear end.
It was great. It was watching the reactions of, like, Don and Roger. Like,
yeah.
Don almost had, like, this giddy look on his face when he was, like, pulling the curtain away, pulling the curtain closed so that they could witness this.
Well, you know, it's like Joe said, everyone had in the office had wanted to do that to Pete. It was one of those situations where sometimes, you know, two people just have to fight. I mean, it's the only way to deal with it. And we know Roger's past was boxing during the Great Depression. He was attempting to be a boxer. And we know Don had a hard scrabble life. So, you know, these are the kind of individuals, I think, who are like, well, you know, sometimes you got
to
fight.
They're going to allow this fight to happen, and they're going to enjoy watching it on the sidelines.
Oh, for sure. And I thought Pete, he deserved a little comeuppance there. I mean, I thought that Lane, I mean, maybe he was a little too self-righteous about the whole thing, but I felt that they could have seen how sensitive he was towards his own role and perhaps been a little softer on the man. I mean, he is helping, you know, keep the finances straight.
Yeah, exactly. It was just, I mean, it was clearly Pete got too big for his britches and he needed to be knocked down a peg or two. And I mean, we all thought it was going to be Roger versus Pete, but it ended up being Lane just saying enough is enough, and he just went at it. I mean,
and then goes right at Joan too. Lane was just, he was, adrenaline was pumping. He was fired up.
No, Lane was definitely fired up. The fact that he went after Joan was great.
I know. She handled that very deftly too. I mean, she handles everything very deftly, but I felt last season and the season before, actually, she didn't really have enough scenes, and I feel like they're sort of rebooting her as a character this year. And I just like the way she does everything so smoothly as a character. So, like, she knows every person in the office very well, handles them perfectly. I mean, you know, it makes sense. Although I had been thinking the first couple episodes, is there going to be some sort of romantic interlude with Lane and Joan because they're both pretty vulnerable? But I guess not.
Well, I mean,
or at least not as of yet.
Yeah, I don't know if we can put a definitive nail in the coffin on that one. Yeah, but it was definitely, I mean, to your point on Joan, she's definitely clearly like the super secretary, if you will. She's definitely clearly more than what her role is. And the fact that Lane even admits that, like, she could do his job.
Right. I thought that was very revealing, actually.
Very good as well. And Lane, again, is much like Roger in the fact that he, I mean, they're all, I mean, you know, the entire theme of this season seems to be the whole kind of fish out of water, you know, like they're not in their usual circumstances and they need to figure out how they're going to live in this new world as it's changing around them sort of thing.
Yeah.
But Lane definitely doesn't have much power either. So it was good to see him kind of become powerful again.
No, I agree. I agree.
I mean, he's never been. I want to say this might be the first time he's actually taken some power. Like for the entire time he's been in the series, even
he plays
when
the background.
Yeah, exactly. Even when he was at the original Sterling Cooper, you know, he was getting fed lines from his English bosses all the time, you know, and they were going to move him to India or whatever.
Right.
So, I mean, he really hasn't exuded his own will on anything, so I thought that was good to see him finally do something like that.
Well, it was like when he tried to break away from his wife and tell his father, who plays General Trimble in the Gettysburg movie, that's the only thing I know about that guy, comes and lays him in. Our classic scene right there in Gettysburg between General Trimble and Martin Sheen as General Lee. Anyway, you know, it's kind of like he came to America. You almost feel like he wants to assert himself, but he just doesn't really know how to do it. And I thought this, you know, he was like, okay, I'm going to get this account. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's kind of trying to make things happen on his own. And I like that he's, you know, taking some forays out there.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. The fact, I mean, that was just hilarious, the way they lost that account. And in general, the whorehouse scene, if you will.
Yeah,
especially,
for sure.
Especially Pete, you know, especially the whore giving Pete suggestions and him just being like, nope. And then all of a sudden, she goes, king.
I thought that was actually a pretty good scene, though.
It was a really good scene. It was just hilarious as well.
you any good at this? I was a fan. I thought obviously it made sense. I have to say I had a little. I mean, it was really ridiculous, the whole thing with him and the 16-year-old. I mean, what was that about?
I don't. I mean, I guess he was. Like I said, I think he was just trying to. I mean, he's just trying to be what he's grown up around, I guess, you know? Like, he's seen all these people that are older than him at the office kind of do all these things, and he's like, well, now it's my turn. But because the world has been changing around him, I mean, it's not happening. I mean, not that he's as handsome or as charming, like I said, as Don is. But yeah, the fact that he's trying to hook up with a 16-year-old that clearly doesn't want it in the first place, is really weird.
I mean, it just struck me as kind of like a last ditch, like, you know, like I got nothing else going for me, but here's like some low hanging fruit. So you know, I think I agree with your earlier point. It will be very interesting to see. Does he really just start to spiral, or does he sort of go back to the old Pete, who may be disgruntled, but you know. Sort of keeps on treading water, allowing his wife to be his principal motivator.
I mean, I think Pete's going to need to do something big here, at least probably account-wise, you know, or else he's kind of not doing anything there either. Like, they're kind of stuck in this place, and they haven't really moved forward at all this season. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see where some of these characters go.
No, there's no doubt about that. But I like Game of Thrones, I think that the season feels very promising to me.
Yes. No, I'm very excited as well. I think we have to mention before we end this the explanation of one of Ken's stories, not the one where he's writing at the end.
But the bridge thing, which was so clearly an allegory. For the position he feels he's in at his job. That's what I took out of it.
Yeah. So what you were taking out was that he feels like he's a robot at the job, and he doesn't do anything, but he's going to somehow bring the company down? Because, I mean,
he's going to bring the company down.
Well, I mean, the story is about, you know, this robot that is, you know, everyone basically shits on this robot. All he has to do is maintenance on the bridge. And the only thing, I don't know, they didn't make it clear to if the robot had decision, you know, made the decision, or if he was, like, he knew what that loosing that bolt was going to do,
right.
Or if he was just doing his tasks and that's what happened. But, the robot ends up loosening the bolt at, like, the middle of the bridge, and the entire thing collapses.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, that's just what I took out of it. And maybe it's not just him. Maybe that's how he views a lot of people who work there. You know, or who knows? Maybe it's a metaphor for the broader changes in society going on at that moment. I mean, that would make sense, too.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to mention Alan's comment here. I'm sure he'll end up writing something about it later this week. But he's got something about this whole story. And what he is saying is that it could be an analogy about advertising. I don't know if I agree with this, but maybe Ken thinks that advertising is somehow damaging the society, which, I mean, it is. I don't know if you can extrapolate that from that particular story, because it's more about taking away than trying to make you do things, you know, trying to make you buy things or anything like that. Like, I don't know.
True, but I don't know. I mean, I think it might fit in, again, with the broader tenor of the times. He could see a big incongruity between the changes happening in society and the job he does, and, like, trying to push and manipulate people in any way possible to buy these goods and to like certain things. I could see that.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about all of the references of real-life historical events? Like, I feel like in this season particularly, we've just been hit over the head. Each episode has something, some new, clearly some new historical event that plays into the theme of the episode. Last week, you know, was the whole nurse murders thing. And this week we had the mention of the University of Texas sniper.
Right. And then the Democratic National Convention popped up a couple episodes back, I believe. So, yeah, I think – well, I mean, I think on the one hand it helps just from a dating perspective give you a sense of the pace of the show. Mm-hmm. I think that – you know, part of it is, though, I think just part of it is really just like almost like a marketing thing. Like, you know, it plays to people's nostalgia to think about, you know, these events. And I think it helps, you know, I think it helps build the conversation about the story, because then people are going to say, even if it doesn't really talk about the event that much, or if it does, like, oh, how do you relate this to that? How do you relate this to that? And I don't even know if Weiner and the rest of them are even thinking that deeply about it, but it certainly does help sort of provoke discussion and thought about the show, you know, by tying in the characters' actions to real life things.
Yeah, I mean, they had that sort of throwaway line there too, where Bert Cooper is like, where Don said something about like, oh, there's no way LBJ is gonna continue this war before the election, and then
Bert Cooper's like, just like,
you never end a war before an election.
Right. So yeah, there's been a couple throwaway lines that, I mean, like, you know, in the Bert Cooper and the domino theory at that dinner party, the Don birthday party. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, it definitely pops up. I just wonder I wonder how long sort of these brief references are really going to hold up before it just seems like kind of an affectation, or to what degree are they going to let, like, I mean, I'd almost prefer them to take one or two historical events and maybe try to build more of a storyline out of it, as opposed to just sort of name checking things that happen.
Well, yeah, no, they did that in the first season with the Nixon Kennedy election. That was kind of a bit of a running storyline.
Right.
And then they also had that one episode where the JFK assassination.
Right.
Really changed the episode and kind of changed how everyone acted and stuff after that. So it should be interesting to see. I mean, I'm assuming there's going to be some sort of civil rights riot sort of thing that kind of changes the whole landscape of everything.
Well, they've alluded to riots a couple times, but haven't really delved into it. I mean, you know, I actually kind of, and I told you this off pod, obviously, because I'm only here as a volunteer, you know, that I felt that actually the only reason they really brought anything race-related into it is because they got criticized for it in the past two off seasons. I mean, I haven't really seen them integrate it terribly well into – I mean, I just thought they missed a huge storyline when Pete brought up to them last season that, you know, there's all these black companies out there and businesses, and that, you know, they could potentially get this business and use it to make money, especially because in 1968 is when the first black person was hired on Madison Avenue. So to me, that would have been like a more real, I mean, instead of just hiring a random secretary and having her spend the night at Peggy's house and have Peggy think like, oh, what if she steals my purse? Like, I mean, okay. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, I think I'm going to say that's more of a planned thing as opposed to them just not putting it in, because I feel like in this specific circle that these people are running in, you know, it was done very well last week in the nurse murder episodes, where everyone was more obsessed with the nurse murders in the office,
right?
Because that more hit home. That was kind of more in their circle than the race riots were. You know, like, they're not gonna, they don't really, they might not. I don't know if caring is the right word, but like, the race riots haven't really affected their lives yet. So I think it might end up becoming, like, a fairly poignant moment, because we have been getting, you know, like, kind of event checks, like you were saying, on the race riots and the civil rights movement in general. So I think once it finally, like, infiltrates and, like, hits – the agency, it might be more of an event than if they had just had the one episode and then just kind of either forgot about it or didn't mention it again, you know?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I mean, I actually agree with you. I mean, I think that it was planned, and that's why, like, I haven't been so happy with it, because I feel like they kind of went away from their plan mm-hmm. to just answer criticism instead of trying to work it in a real way. I mean, if you're going to do it, do it. But, you know, they're almost trying to do too much, like name-checking different civil rights stuff, trying to have a little bit of that in there, trying to have a little bit of the war tension in there. I mean, like, you know, it's kind of like, not that all those things aren't relevant and important, but I find that's often the problem with shows about the, like, that horrible Mad Men ripoff show that NBC had that got canceled right away. I can't even remember what it was. Yeah. And it was like they tried to touch on every single social struggle and issue of the 60s in the first like 30 minutes of the show. And I was kind of like, whoa. I mean, it's all relevant, but you know, if you're trying to do one show, sometimes you gotta, I mean, just like The Wire, you know, like they were dealing with a lot of different things, but they would kind of focus season by season. And I want to see Mad Men go more in that direction and not go in the direction of just like randomly throwing in this, that, and the third, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think we're pretty much, I mean, I don't know. I think they're building towards something with the civil rights struggle. I think that's what they're doing. So I'm going to reserve judgment on that.
Yeah, and I think Peggy's boyfriend is a Trojan horse for a lot of this too.
Yeah.
And they'll probably bring in some more of this as conflict between him and her mm-hmm. over maybe choices he makes, choices she makes, whatever.
Exactly. So I mean, I don't know. I'm gonna reserve judgment. I think it's definitely building somewhere, and I think it'll end up being good. Before we go there, though, I feel like we need to talk about the previews for the next episode.
They're very tricky. They're the worst.
You never
know what the hell is going to happen.
Exactly. Like, I understand wanting to be secret and, like, not wanting to give too much away. But with your
secret
preview is, like, 30 seconds long of just people being like, what happened? Oh, no, you're in danger. And then, like, seven different shots of, like, people either looking at the camera or looking at each other. Like, what the hell kind of preview is that?
No, their previews are horrible, and they've always been that way. I mean, it's just, like, random cuts of people saying stuff, and it gives you no idea what's going to happen. It drives me insane in terms of, like, I'm always like, okay, let's see what's going to happen. I don't know why I keep looking at the previews, like, okay, let's see what happens next week when I know they aren't going to reveal it to me.
I mean, to me, I think I might just start watching them for the humor of it, because it's just so ridiculous at, like, how nonspecific they all are.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I feel like they should at least, like, give you a theme for the episode, you know? Like, just having people ask random questions that don't seem to have any bearing on anything definitely doesn't give you a very nice preview. I mean, like I said, clearly Weiner wants to keep a lid on everything. But there's no point in having a preview if you're not going to say anything.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't even know why you want to keep a lid on it so much. I mean, like, every good show that I've ever known will show you quite a bit. I mean, I remember, like, The Sopranos used to give you a pretty solid preview of what was going to happen next time, and it never made me, like, less willing to watch or something like that, or spoil the episode.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if I was just a first-time watcher, and I watched this episode this week, and I was like, okay, that was a good episode, but, you know, I'm not quite sold on it yet, and then the preview comes on, I'm going to be like, fuck this.
It's not going to hook you. It's not going to make you think, like, oh, I better make sure I tune in next week.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. I think they either need to get rid of them or change them up altogether.
I agree.
But, yeah, I think that's going to do it for the TV podcast.
Shut it down.
It was nice having Eugene back on the podcast. Hopefully we'll be able to get the sports pod back up and running at some point or another.
We'll bring it back. I'm not even worried at all. You know what I'm saying? I'm not worried at all. It's still early in the baseball season.
That's true. We've got a long baseball season ahead of us. We have
the Olympics as well.
We've got a lot of stuff coming up. So hopefully we can get at least a semi-regular sports pod going on. If you didn't check out the website yet, you should definitely come by. We've changed the entire look of the thing. It looks
brand new.
Exactly. It looks much better. Hopefully it'll function a little better. Hopefully it'll make you click on some other things that you might not have thought about before. As usual, we haven't changed the URL, so it's still at in-the-bagwith2gs.com. So definitely come on out and check that out as well. We'll have a lot. Hopefully we'll have a couple of new segments every week, maybe a daily segment. I know Eugene's got his article coming up every Tuesday. It's a sports article, sports media sort of thing. It's real good. You guys should check that out. And yeah,
follow it on, like it on Facebook, follow it on Twitter, In the Bag. Follow exactly. In the Bag.
You can do that. You can like individual articles as well. You can email them, you know, do all of that stuff. Tell your friends, tell your moms, tell your dads. Get them on the soapbox and just start telling people to come see In the Bag.
That's right. That's
but,
right.
Yeah, I think that's going to do it. We'll come at you guys next week, maybe a little earlier. And, yeah, later.
Peace.